if we're thinking about having real lasting change on the environment and we focus on the role of behaviour change in that, then we need to really focus on those behaviours that, if we were to achieve behaviour change, it would deliver real impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast of The Decision Lab, a socially conscious applied research firm that uses behavioral science to improve outcomes for all of society. My name is Brooke Strzok, Research Director at TDL, and I'll be your host for the discussion. My guest today is Kate Laffin, Behavioral Science Fellow at the OECD, Marie Curie Fellow at the University College Dublin, and Visiting Fellow at the London School of Economics. In today's episode, we'll be talking about nudging towards sustainable behaviors, different ways to think about the topic, where these nudges are most needed, and how to make them work. Kate, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we really get started, tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you're up to these days.
Yes. So as you correctly mentioned, I'm a Marie Curie Fellow at University College Dublin. Essentially what that fellowship involves is just 2 years of considered research time to dig deep into a specific challenge. And the challenge that I'm interested in exploring is intention behavior gaps in environmentally significant consumption behavior. So lots of technical jargon in there, but I'm sure we'll get into some of the details before long.
Yeah, let's dive right in. That was already a mouthful. Environmentally significant consumption behaviors. Another term out there in the ecosystem that I know that you've used and written about is pro-environmental behaviors. Can you talk us through these terms? What do they mean?
Absolutely. So as I define it, at least, pro-environmental behavior is actions that we take with the specific intent to have beneficial impacts on the environment. So you can think about things like recycling, as well as making a choice to buy an electric car for environmental reasons. And those are really important behaviors that we want to understand and encourage from a behavioral science perspective. But maybe even more important, at least I think so, is environmentally significant consumption behavior. And that's just a really fancy way of saying any behavior that we engage in that has knock-on impacts on the environment. From my perspective, it's really important to understand those behaviors and look to promote pro-environmental action within those behaviors, because lots of actions that we take, like the food that we consume, we may not make those choices based on environmental concerns, but they will have knock-on impacts on our impact on the environment. And so really trying to understand and shape those behaviors is what I'm looking to do, my current research project.
If I can boil it down to a really simple label for each one, pro-environmental behaviors are really intentions focused, whereas environmentally significant consumption behaviors are much more outcomes focused. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would consider myself, on a good day, I would consider myself a consequentialist for the most part. So I'm really interested in that overall impact on the environment in the end of the day. And intentions only so far as that helps us to have those good impacts.
You've talked about the advantage of combining these approaches as opposed to dogmatically committing ourselves to either one to the exception of the other. What's the advantage of using them together?
I'm specifically interested in intention behavior gaps, as I mentioned before. One of the reasons I'm interested in that in specifically is because where there are intention behavior gaps in environmentally significant consumption behavior, I've got to stop saying that. But where there are intention behavior gaps in those behaviors, people often end up having way more negative impacts on the environment than they themselves ever intended to do. And so you've already got a group of people there who have these intentions. They may be for environmental reasons, they may be for health reasons, environment, animal welfare reasons, all sorts of reasons, to behave in ways that would benefit the environment or reduce their negative impacts on the environment, but they're failing to follow through. Bringing those two things together helps us identify a population who, if we were to design context or engage with them in certain ways that help them follow through on the things that they intend to do, we could have these beneficial impacts without ever trying to change people's minds.
The benefit that you're looking for there is to tap into those intentions as a lever for behavioral change. Is that correct?
Absolutely. But also in terms of thinking about who best to target. So we may want to target people from a behavioral science perspective, people who already have intentions to, for example, reduce their meat consumption. We may want to target them differently than people who we're trying to change their minds and convince them that it is maybe a good idea that they reduce their meat consumption for health reasons or environmental reasons. So not just because they think it will lead to impact, but it also informs the kinds of interventions that we might want to design.
And you mentioned trying to do this without really changing people's minds or converting them to adopt a different set of values that they don't already hold.
It's not that I don't think that there is a role for behavioral science in thinking about how to communicate on important policy topics like environmental issues and trying to bring people who aren't necessarily engaged in those topics along. It's just that in this project, I'm really interested in those people that are kind of already on board. And it's about really thinking about what is it happening in their day-to-day lives. Maybe they're not acting as well or as pro-environmentally as they might want to.
Let's dive into the topic areas or the behaviors themselves that you're working on most. In some of your writing, you've highlighted that food, transportation, and housing are three areas that have lots and lots of potential. Can you talk us through that? Why are you focused on these areas specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. So that focus is born out of a frustration that I share with some people in the environmental psychology literature. That work has typically looked at behaviors that have been easy to research or have sometimes been considered headline environmental behaviors like recycling, for example. And it's not that I think people should stop recycling or that it's not a worthy act, but if we're thinking about having real lasting change on the environment and we focus on the role of behavior change in that, then we need to really focus on those behaviors that if we were to achieve behavior change, it would deliver real impact. There's been lots of research that's recently looked at that and asked, what are those key headline behaviors that we need to be targeting? And as you correctly said, food is really important, in particular food waste, meat consumption, travel behavior matters a whole lot, as does the kind of heating you use in your house. So those behaviors are my focus precisely because if we manage to change behavior in those areas, it would deliver real impact.
Okay, let's talk through some of the individual behaviors that fall into those buckets. And especially, I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk through the impact and intention profile of these things. So thinking about both the outcomes and the intentions that are relevant here. So let's start with food. What are some of the key behavioral dimensions, some of the key decisions around food and their impact and intention profile?
The two key ones from an impact perspective are on your consumption of animal-based proteins. And you can break that down. So that includes everything from dairy products to meat. You can break meat down into things like poultry and ruminant meat. If you were to rank them all, red meat, so ruminant meat, is the most carbon intensive. So if you're looking at it from a carbon perspective, that would be the area that you'd focus. But across the spectrum, you're seeing animal-based proteins being more environmentally demanding and destructive than plant-based proteins, typically. My own work in this project is specifically looking at red meat consumption. I'll also consider the consumption of dairy products in some further follow-up work, but that's a key area. In terms of intentions, then, looking at meat consumption, if you look across Europe, on average, one in every three people has some intention to reduce their meat consumption over the next period. In preparation for this podcast, I looked at Canada as well, and it was equivalent. So a 2018 survey looked at intentions to reduce meat over the next 6 months, and it was, a third of people. So not everywhere around the world, people are holding the same level of intentions, but certainly it's a substantial proportion of the population. And as I said before, it's not necessarily all about the environment. Lots of people particularly cite health reasons for that.
Moving on from food to transportation, what are the big choices, the big decisions that we should be thinking about there?
Transportation is key. One of the things that I found really interesting that I read recently is varies a lot depending on your socioeconomic status. So if you're looking at people who have a high socioeconomic status, particularly those people who are traveling a lot by air, so taking a lot of flying around the world on a regular basis, then that's the area of their consumption that's really the most impactful and that should be targeted. Really importantly, though, that's not the majority of the population. So if we look at the travel of everyone altogether, it's actually a minority of people that do have multiple flights a year, transatlantic flights, for example. For them, it'll be their everyday travel choices, like whether they take the car versus commuting by public transport, bike, by foot. Both matter. And I think it really highlights the point that it depends on the population that you're interested in, whose behavior you're interested in changing, to know which behaviors exactly you want to target.
And what about the intention profile of those kinds of behaviors? What are you seeing in terms of people's desire to change and desire to have a smaller footprint?
There's this one great paper that's titled something like Green on the Ground, but Not in the Air. And that lots of people who state environmental values are still regularly flying. And whether they're having these intention behavior gaps, we don't have the data on that. But certainly, we might have some work to do in terms of fostering intentions to reduce things like air travel that may not already be there in the same way that they are with meat consumption.
I like that title, Green on the Ground, but Not in the Air. It brings up a very nice image of someone driving a very expensive Tesla and feeling that they're really doing their environmental part, but at the same time, taking lots of vacations and flying a lot for business, easily surpassing whatever offset they might have from having switched to an electric car.
I myself have been guilty of, so it's important that we all reflect.
It's not them, it's us. Because we're all in it. And finally, moving on to housing. So you mentioned earlier that it's really around heating, and I presume cooling as well is also part of that. Maybe heating and cooling are things that we don't think about so much as behaviors, but certainly there's a behavioral angle to them. So tell us a little bit about that.
It comes back to something that I've been thinking about for a long time in terms of, as a behavioral scientist, looking at environmental issues. Are you looking to try to change those habitual behaviors that on aggregate have these impacts? Or should you focus your efforts on one-offs that if you were to achieve a change in the moment would yield benefits long-term? So the obvious example in this context would be changing energy provider from a gray to a green tariff. And how could behavioral science speak to making people make that switch so that once they've switched this one intervention, then continues to yield benefits going forward. And I would see, particularly in housing, those being very relevant. Obviously, eating and travel are things that we do all the time. And so how we intervene in those spaces might be very different from how we intervene on those one-off behaviors, but might be just as impactful if we could get the right moment and people change once and it continues to benefit in the long term.
Let's dive in a little bit into the work that you've been doing around the action intention gap. So, you know, you've kind of marked out the territory of the key behaviors that we really want to be kind of moving the needle on. What are you seeing in terms of people's action intention gaps? Where are the most pressing gaps?
So I can certainly tell you where the most pressing gaps in our knowledge about why these gaps come about is. There has been a long history of looking at this. This is not a new phenomenon. All of us we just need to look at our own behavior to know that we don't always follow through on our good intentions. But obviously, there's been a huge amount of research on why that is as well. And in particular, that research has told us that there's certain kinds of intentions, for example, that people are more likely to follow through on. So if you have promotion goals, so positive goals, like I will go to the gym, as opposed to negative goals, like I won't binge watch Netflix, for example, you're more likely to follow through on those positive goals. The sort of more wishy-washy it is, the easier it is for us to fail to follow through. So we know a bit about what kinds of intentions people manage to follow through on. We also know a fair bit about which people are more likely than others to follow through on their intentions. So people who are more present biased tend to fail more often. People who are low in conscientiousness tend to fail more often. So we have a bit of a profile of who and what kinds of intentions. We know far less about what are the situational drivers of intention behavior gaps. So what is it about a given afternoon or a given context that makes people fail to follow through in a way that they won't on another day, at another time, in another place? And so really that's what my work is trying to do in relation to environmental behaviors. But equally, I think it's broader than that. It's going to try to say something to the literature at large as well about the importance of these situational characteristics and trying to really get a handle on what are those important characteristics that get in our way.
Let's dive into air travel in particular. So this is one that obviously you mentioned, it's a very specific segment of the population that's responsible for most of the environmental impact that results from this. And obviously with COVID, air travel has been massively disrupted. And a big part of that is the disruption of workplaces and disruption of work patterns. Now that things are easing up, opening up, hopefully long may that trend continue. What are we seeing in terms of changes that last in people's air travel behaviors, especially around business travel?
It's something that I've been working on a little bit in the lead up to, and I think it's an outstanding question. We don't know what the lasting impact of this disruption is going to be, but what I'd like to do is highlight this as an opportunity. So our pre-existing habits of the kinds of times we go on meeting, kinds of meetings we felt like needed to be in person, the kinds of events that we would travel halfway across the world for, all of that's been disrupted. And habit discontinuity theory would suggest that once we've had a disruption in that sort of everyday automatic responses to situations, be they at work or at home, there's an opportunity then to leverage that to rethink and to say, okay, actually ask the question, does that meeting need to be in person? Do we need to travel for that? Is that event really going to deliver the benefits for our business that merit us going? And so that's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently and I'm working on in the hope that I can partner with organizations in order for them to assess and really think about their travel going forward. It's not something that I think we know the answer to yet, but I certainly think there's a moment of opportunity.
What kinds of interventions are we trying and how are we measuring those things in order to get some traction on this?
So to date, I haven't seen a huge amount of work on thinking about the transition out of COVID and what that means for sustainability. I think there's a couple of key things you've already correctly identified: business travel. There's also the question of flexible work arrangements and working from home. And all of a sudden, lots of employers are facing a situation when their employees are no longer under their roofs anymore, but will still have environmental impacts. Is that off the plate now for the employer? Do they no longer have responsibility, or should they be thinking about ways to engage with their employees in their home sphere in order to pro-environmental behavior while at work at home? I've been thinking about this a bit, and particularly because there's been quite a lot of work on household pro-environmental behavior, some of that could feed into organizations thinking about how to engage with their employees while they're working from home. This is a fast evolving situation. And so I can only look to the existing literature that's looked at households to be able to speak to what employers might try. So the interventions that we've got some of the best evidence on in the pro-environmental sphere are feedback. That's certainly an important one. So it can be really hard for people to understand their absolute levels of consumption. Things like how much energy you're consuming, things like how much water you're consuming, well, compared to what? That's really hard for people to get their heads around. And so providing feedback of various different kinds can help people really understand Are they high consumers, low consumers? Could they be doing better? And within that, there's lots of different kinds of feedback. So there's obviously just direct feedback about your consumption, but some of the most effective approaches to feedback have been relative to your peers. So providing people information about how their consumption relates to their neighbors, relates to their coworkers, for example, that could be an option. That's been proven to be effective. Other areas that I've seen good evidence on is in relation to non-monetary rewards. So you can think about this as ranging from everything from recognizing people for their pro-environmental actions, making that salient, that's a reputational reward, but also pro-social incentives is another one that I've seen work very well, whereby you offer to donate to a charity, for example, if a person acts in a certain way, in a pro-environmental way. And what you're doing there is you're really doubling down on that intrinsic motivation to engage in that action. You're saying not only is it good for the planet, but will also make it good pro-socially if you do engage in this way. We're not trying to save money. We're going to use that money to give to charity. So that's another example. And then a really obvious one, but it's very effective, so I'll come back to it, is just around defaults. So green defaults, if you look across your organization or your household and you look at all the ways in which people go with the flow of preset options, does that make them act in pro-environmental ways or not? So that's things like if you're ordering catering for an event, for example, are you making meat options the default? Is that what people get given if they don't make it specific that they want the vegetarian option? Could you flip that on its head and make sure that everybody gets vegetarian unless they specifically want meat? What's nice about that is you're not boxing off any options for anybody. Anybody who has a very strong preference will end up getting the meal that they want. But for those people who are kind of just going with the flow, they'll end up having lots more vegetarian meals, lower impact on the environment. So green defaults, I think it works in printing, it works in catering, it works in energy thermostat settings. There's lots of evidence that just making those small changes to the environment can have big impacts.
You talked earlier about the disruption to work and this moment to reflect and reset our habits. What are some of the defaults that you think are most valuable to set in a new place now as we return to something like normal work?
One thing that I'm exploring is whether there'd be value in having decision aids in and around things like traveling, asking the questions, does this meeting need to be in person? How many people need to travel for this meeting? A decision aid is one way to go, or you could have a policy that is the default is that you're having that meeting online unless there's a really good reason not to. It only involves travel for those people who are directly responsible for the project, unless there's a really good reason not to. And framing it in that way, it's almost exactly like a decision aid, except you're setting the default as being the pro-environmental option. So travel is certainly one that I think is important.
I think that that's a really valuable and concrete policy suggestion for listeners out there who are trying to think through, like, what is it that they can do to really leverage behavioral insights to improve environmental outcomes, especially in their organizations. As travel becomes possible again, retaining this default that we're meeting remotely, unless there is a compelling reason for the meeting to not be remote, in that case, putting together very clear guidelines about when something rises to the level of meriting an in-person meeting, and also putting together clear guidelines about who is absolutely essential. Moving slightly away from the environmental angle for just one second, I think all of work could be really improved by more critical reflection on who needs to be in a meeting.
Or whether there needs to be a meeting, or how long it needs to be.
How many transatlantic trips could have just been an email the whole time?
And but meeting time as well, I think that's a really important one. Like, could there be a default that all meetings be 30 minutes? Obviously, there'll be some instances in which you need to extend those meetings. But if the default is an hour, you're going to use up that space. You're going to use up that time. So there's lots of ways that I think behavioral science can speak to making organizations work better beyond just in the environmental sphere.
So thinking about the organizational context and moving away from travel now a little bit, what are some other defaults and decision aids that organizations can think about to improve environmental outcomes?
One thing that I really feel strongly about is that all organizations will have different profiles. There's been a big push in thinking about sustainable organizations in doing things like a carbon accounting exercise for each organization. And what that really will do is it'll look across an organization's functions and look to see where their most heavy impacts are. And they kind of break them up into different scopes. So the first scope is direct emissions that are coming from an organization's activities. Scope two are those emissions that come from the heating and energy that an organization uses. And scope three is pretty much everything else. So that'll be things like your work travel, your food in your canteen, stationery, the furniture, everything else that is involved in running an organization. And doing an exercise like that, I think, is important because it doesn't say, okay, well, for everybody, for every organization, what they need to do is sort out their canteen. Or what they need to do is sort out their business travel. Making a sense like that just ignores the nuance that exists across organizations. And so what I would really put forward is the importance of doing an exercise like carbon accounting and then bringing a behavioral lens to it. So saying, of those areas of consumption that we have that have these environmental impacts, which are the ones that have the biggest impact? And to what extent does human behavior play a role in them? And once you have that analysis carried out, you'll very quickly begin to identify which are the behaviors for your organization, for your employee population that have the greatest sort of potential impact. That would be my advice. And equally, depending on the kind of organization, maybe you don't need to do a whole carbon accounting exercise, but maybe you have a good sense of what are the activities that your company engages in and what are they likely to be the most impactful behaviors amongst those.
So that's a really helpful step-by-step process for someone who cares deeply about this and wants to take meaningful action, starting with a carbon accounting exercise. And what will emerge from there is the set of priorities, like which are the behaviors that are most in need of being shifted in terms of decreasing environmental impacts. And then thinking about the behavioral angle or the decision science angle behind that, what are the pathways that are leading people to make key decisions that are getting them along that pathway that's high output? I'm wondering whether you can take us one step further and within that behavioral angle, thinking specifically about action intention gaps.
Currently, the best literature around how to overcome intention behavior gaps involves cognitive strategies for the most part. So there are really well trodden paths, really well evidenced solutions, if then planning. So implementation intentions is another term that's used for the same thing. It basically asks the question, you know, there is a goal that you're trying to achieve. You have these intentions, but you recognize that it's not always easy to follow through on them. You engage in a planning exercise that brings you through, okay, if this situation arises that's linked to that intention, here's how I'm going to act. It's been really well shown in things like voting, for example. You want to go to the polling station, you have all this intention to vote, but studies show that you're not necessarily going to convert that into action. When are you going to go vote? How are you going to get there? What time are you going to go? If you have kids, who are going to mind the kids? Are you going to bring them with you? Trying to put all of that planning in and around those intentions makes it more likely that you'll follow through. A second strategy that's effective as well is just monitoring. One of the reasons that we fail to follow through on our intentions is we often forget, don't pay enough attention to them. And so if it's a very important intention in an organizational space, creating some sort of monitoring around whether people are acting as they intend, getting feedback about that is something that can help intentions to turn into actions. So those are the cognitive type strategies that have been well evidenced in this space. And it's a bit premature for me to come in and say I've got any better answers, but I don't think I have better answers, but maybe complementary ones. Once my project has come to completion, hopefully I'll have a better sense of what are the really important situational drivers of these intention behavior gaps. And maybe the strategies won't be any different, but we'll know better how to target those strategies. And I think understanding the role of context and maybe even interventions embedded in context will give us further tools to be able to address these gaps.
So you mentioned that certain people or certain personality types are more prone to overcome the action intention gap and others less. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Just that there's a huge heterogeneity across people. Part of the reason might be, so as you mentioned, yeah, there's people who are present bias, people who are low in conscientiousness, people who don't plan as much. All of these reasons that are part of these lead to intention behavior gaps, it seems.
Is there something that we can do to help nudge people towards overcoming some of those predictors that are likely to impede them?
I think important in all of that is our recognition that we can fail to follow through on intentions. Oftentimes when we are in a cold state, our sort of rational head on, we tend to think, you know, we're going to have no problem following through. I've set this diet intention. Of course, I'm going to be able to follow through on that. I feel very strongly about it. It's Monday morning and I feel very strongly about it. I'll have no problem. And then over time in different contexts, you know, there's temptations. We might be in a bad mood, for example. We might be presented with a chocolate cake, for example. We're in those hot states. It's often very hard to convert those cold intention into action. And maybe recognizing what are those triggers, what are those environmental triggers that lead us to fail to follow through, what gets in our way, I think is one of those tools that can help us. And it is borne out by the implementation intention literature that if then planning that I mentioned, a further development of that is mental contrasting, which requires you to do those plans, but also asks you what could get in your way. And if something's going to get in your way, how are you going to overcome it? So maybe for those of us who find it hard to follow through with a given domain, I think we'll all have domains in which we find it tricky enough. What are those contextual factors or those things that get in our way that we can either avoid or come up with other strategies to be able to resist temptation and carry on with the actions we wanted to?
Yeah, that's interesting. So that really seems to fit into this work that you're doing around situational factors, thinking not just who are the people who are going to be prone to kind of fall off the wagon, but in which contexts for which people, and how can we make sure that the intervention that we're putting together is well adapted to not just the individuals who are going to need to go through the system and deal with this process and that kind of thing, but also to really hit people in the right situation that they're going to find themselves in when confronted with this.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the person and the situation coming together in a way that has long existed in social psychology, but we don't always think about in behavioral intervention design.
So at the individual level, what is it that we can do to help ourselves to most bring our intentions into reality, to best follow through on our intentions?
It depends, I think, on what stage you're at. So one of the things that we know about intention behavior gaps is that they emerge across different stages. So it could be that you have this intention, but you don't really get started. You have this intention, you get started, but you're in it. And then somehow over the course of trying to enact that intention over time, you kind of fall off the wagon. And then the last way that it can fail is that, you know, if you're working towards a goal completion, you get pretty far, you get almost the way there. You kind of feel like you've done your bit in whatever way, in environmental ways, health ways, and you kind of stop short. And so depending on where you're at with your goals, I think even reflecting on that, like where are you at with, in terms of, are you just trying to get started? Are you halfway there? Are you almost there? That can help. And different strategies will help depending on where you are. So I won't go through them all, but if you're thinking about just getting started with an intention, for example, lots of behaviors and lots of intentions that we want to map onto behaviors will have things that involve needing to prepare for them. It's not just the behavior itself, but there's many things that might need to be in place in order for you to enact that behavior. So you take, for example, meat consumption as an intention that you might want to enact. Well, that requires a consumption decision in the moment, but it also depends if you're at home, what's in your fridge, how much time do you have? There's lots of other factors that play into whether you're able to make that choice in the moment or not. If you've got nothing but meat in your fridge, there's no way that you're going to be able to follow through on that intention. If it's about getting started, then you might want to think about what are the preparatory behaviors that lead you to get to that point where you're able to make that consumption choice. It'll be different when you're thinking about if you're at different stages.
What about behavioral activation? Do you think that that's something that's among the interventions that you've seen, this kind of idea of like, start small. If my plan is to go and run 10 kilometers, I don't start by saying tomorrow morning, I'm going to hop out of bed full of energy and go and run 10 kilometers. I say tonight, I'm going to put out my shoes and that's going to be the start. And tomorrow I'm going to put on my shoes. Day by day, I'll just build up to getting there. That's intervention strategy that seems to make the rounds quite a bit in terms of its intervention power, if you will. How would you say that ranks relative to some other strategies?
I think it's definitely an interesting approach. And it hammers home to me the importance of realistic goals, realistic intentions. It's an interesting one with intention behavior gaps, because often if you have aspirational goals, you might try and actually achieve more towards a goal than if you have a very narrow short-term goal. Like in that example that you give, your overarching goal is to get out the door and go for a run. You don't want to create such small goals, such tiny intentions that you manage to feel like you've done something, but you never actually get to the point where you're achieving the goal that you really want to achieve. I would say there's a nice sweet spot between having too ambitious and too sort of small goals that aren't really getting you where you need to be.
At the structural or institutional level, what is it that employers can do that you think would give the biggest leg up to employees and to consumers who are looking to do their part?
There's so much that I think employers can do. And I think regardless of what the future of work looks like, there's going to be a lot of time that people spend, which is on employers' watches. So whether that be at home or in the office, a lot of your day, a lot of your impact, environmental impact by virtue of a lot of your day being at work, means that employers have this great opportunity to create a desire for behavior change within their employees, but also to facilitate it. And so obviously my current project is more about facilitating rather than creating that initial desire. But I think employees or employers have a role in both, recognizing the environmental impacts of our actions, communicating with their employees about why they should care about that, how that relates to the vision for the company, for example, but then also facilitating it. So, you know, how do you make the behaviors that individuals engage in and around work easy to do in a pro-environmental way? You can think about structural changes around making biking into work easier, subsidizing things like public transport. You might even make it harder for people to do even more polluting activities like car into work. So I think they can make structural changes, but they can also make changes in and around what the company, how the company communicates with their employees.
Well, thank you very much. That's been really helpful. And I think there's a lot in there to digest. And I hope that we can speak again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
If you'd like to learn more about Applied Behavioral Insights, you can find plenty of materials on our website, thedecisionlab.com. There, you'll also be able to find our newsletter, which features the latest and greatest developments in the field, including these podcasts, as well as great public content about biases, interventions, and our project work.